it was square feet, and I thought it was dollar value, and I was going,
I will open the Joint Interim Task Force on Capital Construction Budget Process. Please note that Representative Smith is excused and Representative Buckley is excused, but is anticipated to be returning hopefully shortly. We have about an hour agenda today, largely an overview, I'm going to mispronounce this.
Alice Vivelle.
I came to a conclusion because of your spouse that it's better for university presidents always to have last names that are hard to pronounce, because for a period of time we were doing quite a bit of that. So, and then Mr. Christensen? Okay. So do you want to give us just a brief update of where we are, and then we'll get started with the presentation? And please note, too, that all of our members are here except for the two that I identified, and including the very glad to be here, the legislative fiscal officer, Mr. Rocco, and very glad to be here, Dan's director, Mr. Norton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is now our second meeting of the reconvened task force on capital construction budget process. We have had some discussions about what the work before us is and how much time we think we need over the rest of interim. And so our plan today is to revisit and get an additional update on one of our charges, which is the state-owned building and an assessment of them, including discussion about deferred maintenance. I think the vision is not to meet again until after a short session is over, at which point we are still kind of outlining our work plan as to what it would look like in May, September, and then our report in the fall. I think a lot of it will come out of what discussions we have here today about kind of the current state of life cycle, what maybe models will work best in making future recommendations regarding capital construction budget process and projects, and then also trying to get a better understanding of what exists in terms of deferred maintenance and life cycle issues.
Okay, great. So, what I'm going to show you today is a presentation that actually is an edit from the one that we did from the last legislative session. So the data that you're looking at is actually 2014 data, the end of 2014. We haven't updated it. But the point is to just show you the kind of data that we have and how we look at it, and the updates on where we are in our work process. And I think a lot of the issues that you raised are ones that we actually are working on, and have made some progress on. So I just wanted to share that to you. So,
Alice, can I jump in for just a second, just for the members of the committee that don't sit on the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means? We started working about two biennia ago with the General Government Subcommittee that we did a pretty poor job of actually inventorying our assets, our resources, what are the choices, the policy choices, and actually setting up a plan for how we're going to maintain our physical assets and work around what it is that we want them to do for us for the business purpose. So the Legislative General Government Subcommittee approved us adding Alice and Daniel on two biennia ago one biennia ago, and then has continued to give DAS some resources to do an evaluation of state buildings. And that's the information that we're pulling together for you here. Prior to Alice and Daniel coming on board, you had to look at three different databases. Sometimes information didn't match up between those databases. And so part of what they've been doing is trying to get up for policymakers a broad-based, comprehensive view of what our assets are. And really, that's what this presentation is about for you today.
Thanks, George. So what we do is we give you the inventory, which is for the quantity, the who, what, and where of our portfolio, From a quality perspective, the physical, assessing the physical quality as well as the representational dimensions of buildings, looking at community from the perspective of economic impact, placemaking and accessibility, and looking at modernization and the optimization of our portfolio. Modernization is around the idea of service delivery, so this is supporting the mission of the agencies, and service delivery modalities have changed over time since the buildings of were originated. And then productivity, are the buildings efficient, are they effective, and are they high performance from, you know, different dimensions, including energy and other dimensions. So the next couple of slides are just slides about the snapshot of our portfolio. In our overall portfolio, of course, it includes the universities, which are more than half of our portfolio. They're about 28 million square feet. Our overall portfolio is about 54 million square feet. 4.5 million square feet about are leased from the private sector, and the remaining 21.5 million square feet are state-owned facilities that are owned by agencies.
Okay. This is the area where I was going to try to get a clarification.
Sure.
The combined total, including higher education, obviously is the larger, about 54 million square feet.
Correct.
And the total higher education is 28, and then the total facilities non-higher education is 26. But then it says total state-owned facilities, and it uses the figure 21.
Right.
Is that a subset of both higher ed and state facilities, or just a subset of state?
Just a subset of state.
Okay. Is there some way in the future that we could somehow reflect this so it, I could misunderstand this,
okay,
if I was on mm-hmm. the outside, because I would say state-owned facilities
includes higher ed.
Includes higher ed,
sure.
And that was what I was trying to get to. And I don't know what the good way to do that.
Maybe state agency?
Yeah, state agency.
Okay,
or,
great.
You know, you can get into finer details because it obviously includes legislative branch and judicial branch facilities also.
So, correct.
Which would be small compared to all the others, but
yes.
But it's probably important to understand that your report is largely on the state agency facilities.
It is.
Yes.
It is. That's our purview.
Yeah.
I'm confused now.
Sure.
Okay. Thought I understood it, but the 26 is total facilities, non-higher ed.
It includes leased from the private sector as well as owned.
So state-owned plus state leased equals total state facilities.
Okay.
Right.
Then we add the higher ed
on top of that.
I gotcha.
You know, it's a nomenclature thing, and I think that we need to make
clear. What I'm trying to counter, Senator Girard, is an underlying perception occasionally in this building that somehow, because the universities have independent boards, that they're somehow not state facilities. They are still state facilities. They are.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree that we're on the hook for all their debt.
Yeah. And their future needs also, probably.
Actually, but to your point, the state capital is not in this.
Okay.
Nor is the judicial branch.
Okay.
So those are two that are not captured here.
Just out of curiosity, though, I don't think the legislative branch would have this circumstance, but does the judicial branch lease any facilities through DAS? Because, I mean, they have the Supreme Court building here. And then where is the Court of Appeals? It's not in that building, is it, actually?
I'm not sure.
But they may be doing that all on their own. They're not actually.
Yeah. Senator, I'm not sure how the judicial branch runs through their stuff.
I don't know the answer either.
Okay.
But we can find out. We'll get back to you on that. Okay, so the next slide shows the.
This mouse is losing.
Just shows the total facilities by agency. You know, again, not higher education, but the agencies under the executive branch. As you can see, corrections, DAS, transportation, and military are by far the largest, and then it goes down quite a bit after that. But this is just to give you a sense of you know, what it is that we have. And if you look at the next slide, the top locations, not surprisingly, are Salem and the...
Alice, can I stop? Sure. On that last one you showed, that's an ownership question, isn't it? So
they're owned.
Okay, yes. This is just who owns it. So there's about 17 different agencies that actually own property. Okay.
Actually, there's one more that we forgot.
Okay. But. Yeah. One question I'd have in the statewide facilities here, in terms of particularly like corrections to a high extent, transportation to a lesser, is this just buildings, or are you including actual, for instance, if you were to look at Oregon State Penitentiary or an Oregon State Correctional Institution, they have large recreational yards. Actually, the other institutions have yards, but they're much smaller. Are those included in the square footage, or is it just the building?
It's buildings. So it's not. It doesn't include uncovered things like sites.
Okay.
But having said that, we capture that in other ways.
Okay.
But this represents just the buildings, yes. So the next slide, the two distinctions there are the top five locations by gross square feet and then the top five locations by the number of facilities. You know, they're similar, but they're not the same. And the next slide is the gives the mean age of our facilities with values over $1 million. That's the distribution that you're looking at. So what's interesting about this is that the mean age is 53 years. Actually, now it's 54 years. And the mean age of construction was 1962. So this has obvious implications for our deferred maintenance and kind of the needs that the facilities have.
Do these ages change for, like, the transportation building when it was largely gutted? And
no, this is the origination age.
Yes, okay.
Right. So it doesn't reflect major renovations, to your point. Yes.
But it does raise questions, Senator, about how often do you need to invest in capital renewal to get the building from what it was built in 1960, for example, to make it a modern, useful building now.
Right. So the next slide you're looking at is the leased facilities, and it just shows the distribution of that 4.6 million square feet, also in terms of gross square footage and count. We have a lot of small leases. That's really what this shows. And human services represents about half of the leases, private leases at this date. And they have a very dynamic need. So they're very program-driven, and that's why leases are a really good response for that agency.
Are these costs for lease per square foot, is this... What's included in that cost?
Actually, it does not include the operations and maintenance. So it actually includes the rental rate. Many of our leases are not full service leases, but are triple net leases. So once you add those in, and we don't have the data for all of that, we actually do have it for human services. They've got really pretty robust data. The numbers go up significantly. So whereas our uniform rent rate is at $1.45, more or less, and this would suggest that the private market is less than the uniform rent. In fact, that's not the case. So,
because the state rate includes the operation and maintenance included. It's an all-in cost.
Right. But again, what we're showing you is the best available information. The 10-year lease outlook, this, of course, is different if we were to run the same table today, but I think the trend still holds, which is that we've got a lot of leases that are coming due in this biennium and the next biennium, and then it trails off. But this is a constantly moving chart, but this is part of what we're looking at. We look at what are consolidation opportunities, what's really happening between agencies. And so this is where a lot of the kind of very specific knowledge around what the users are and their agencies, and the work with the real estate group, who really have their pulse on that, matters, and how we develop.
So one of the things we've found is that we've not been very good at being strategic about looking at communities and really forward thinking about, we have a lease coming due 5 years from now. Do we want to re-envision what we're doing in that community? And part of what happens is that we look at what's coming up in the next 18 or 24 months, for example, but we don't look far enough out to either work with the community or the businesses there to really re-envision what we want the space to do. So part of the importance of this work is being able to articulate when are these leases coming due in different communities and finding, is there opportunities to consolidate or do business differently.
And some agencies are actually taking that on by, when they renew their leases, they're trying to align all their leases in that area. DHS is doing that so that when their leases come due, they're all coming due at the same time so that they can make a larger decision and be more efficient.
The public has shown up.
What's that?
Oh, I said the public has shown up. So please feel free to sit anywhere.
Next one. So I think a lot of the discussion has been around this idea of stewardship. And for us, that means, you know, what is routine maintenance? How do we maintain and operate the facilities that we have? How do we keep them in good condition so that they're working? And what are their needs into the future? And looking at that in a planned way. So I thought it would be good to take a moment to just go over these definitions of what is it that we mean. So when we're talking about routine maintenance, what that means is maintenance that you must do, it's on a routine basis to just maintain the current asset for its lifespan without improving or extending its lifespan per se. So an equivalent would be, if I have a car, an oil change is routine maintenance. For a building, if I had a roof, I cleaning out the drains, getting the moss off the roof, doing occasional seals, that is routine maintenance. And that's what every facility does, you know, facility director does as part of their operations. And routine maintenance is not capitalizable. So then there's deferred maintenance. And what deferred maintenance is, maintenance that wasn't performed when it was scheduled, and it's past its useful life, and then it requires immediate repairs so that it doesn't continue to damage other systems around it. Buildings are big, complicated systems. And if you're not maintaining all of the systems, one system can end up damaging another. You know, a roof is a perfect example. If you don't maintain it, you can start affecting the structure by, you know, corroding the structure. You can affect the finishes by, you know, ceilings becoming a mess. You can affect the electrical systems, water and electric systems. I think these are obvious things, but that's what happens when systems aren't replaced when they need to be replaced. So that's deferred maintenance. And it's deferred because it's on a schedule to be capital renewal. That's the idea of capital renewal, but you didn't do it when it needed to happen. So in a car, an analogy would be a timing belt. You know that you've got to replace the timing belt when you reach 80,000 miles, but you could say, nah, I think I'm good, and I'm going to go another 20,000 miles. And maybe you're right, and nothing happens. Or maybe you're wrong, and your whole car seizes up. So that's really kind of the equivalent. So the capital renewal would be replacing the timing belt when it needs to be replaced. So for a mechanical system, it may be, this is a 40-year mechanical system, and in 40 years, I'm going to replace it because I know it needs to be replaced. It's beginning to wear. All of the indicators tell me this is when it needs to be replaced.
So if I was talking about a different operation than the state has, for instance, the most notable one recently, the Portland Airport. theoretically doing everything necessary to maintain the carpet there, but sooner or later the carpet is going to have to be replaced, which is, so that actually is capital renewal then. But if they had had something where they had failed to maintain a roof on one of the structures, and they wouldn't, it wouldn't have normally been something of capital renewal, but it's been deferred so long that it's now, well, that it's actually deferred maintenance. It could have been prevented in a theory. It could have been prevented. Again, like the replacement of the HVAC system is more likely capital renewal.
Right. Capital renewal also refers to scale. So, you know, you may replace a single air handler unit and it fits into a repair because it's just one. But when all of them are having a problem all at the same time in an area, that becomes a system-wide replacement. That fits into capital renewal. So there's...
Senator Girard had a question.
Yes. The question might be more of a comment. We've been using deferred maintenance in, I think, a lot broader sense.
Yeah.
And we haven't used the term capital renewal. I don't mind that. But I think if we're looking at this the way that you defined it, both routine maintenance and deferred maintenance are things that the agencies should be budgeting for, including the universities.
Yeah.
Well, I think deferred maintenance, again, it comes to the issue of scale, because capital renewal can, and it's very often capital renewal that isn't done because of the scale of the work, and then it becomes deferred maintenance. But it's a system-level thing, so it requires really a lot of investment to fix. So I think if it's a small thing, then it's a repair. But once it gets to be a big system-wide thing, you know, then it becomes deferred maintenance that has to be funded through capital. There's just no other way to do that.
Or in some cases, not to make this too confusing, but in some cases we've seen examples where if you do major renewal, it reduces significantly the backlog of deferred maintenance. Because before the item was listed, I'll give you an example. Lincoln Hall at PSU had a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance. Ultimately, we had to pay to have it, the renewal of the entire building. But that deferred maintenance that was listed in their list of deferred maintenance that needed to be addressed was reduced also, because that building was then off of that list.
Yeah. Here's the problem I have, and I really think we need to send a real clear signal to agencies and the universities as to what they are expected to do and to maintain the buildings. And so the way that this is, look, if you just choose not to do routine maintenance and it becomes deferred maintenance, then we'll pay for it. Well, that doesn't give them any incentive to do the routine maintenance. So I understand your definitions, but I think that we might have to dive into it a lot deeper so that people know exactly what they're expected to do.
I think that's fair. I would say that if an asset, you know, if a mechanical system doesn't live up to its expected life because you haven't done the routine maintenance, or sometimes you get a lemon, right? I mean, that happens too, that you have something that just for whatever reasons doesn't live up to expected life. That doesn't happen that often. Usually they do live up to their expected life. So if it is living beyond its expected life, you know, then it's because you didn't do a capital renewal project when it needed to be done. But capital renewal, because of the scale of it, that has to be projects that are capitalized. They're too big for them to be just running off of, you know, a reserve fund, I would think.
So, Senator Girard, there's another aspect of this, too, which is we haven't always been good at budgeting agencies to actually build in the maintenance costs. That's, I think, one of the conversations this committee can have, is that even when we've built new buildings, we haven't budgeted in for them to maintain those buildings going to go forward. So because it's not budgeted in, it just kind of gets worse and worse, and then we hit exactly what you're talking about. There are examples for DAS-owned buildings. We charge ourselves rent and we put that money that is rent, because we actually own the buildings, there's no rent for it, but we charge ourselves rent, we put that money into a depreciation fund, which is what you're talking about, so that we can do ongoing maintenance as we go forward. Most of the other agencies of the 17 that are out there don't have, they don't use that kind of mechanism. And we would need to budget, working with you all, as we set the budgets for agencies to incorporate that into their budgets. That absolutely could be a recommendation that we come out with this group, and I think would be a very important conversation to have.
So I can give you an example of one of those that isn't really probably really identified. I would guess that the Department of Corrections is primarily all state-owned, not leased facilities. There might be a few examples. There could be a probation office out there that the state has to run because they no longer, the county will run it. But we gave them a kind of, they asked for and we gave them a very small sum for deferred maintenance, which when you compare it to the number of facilities they have, the age of the facilities, there's probably a lot that is going undone in those facilities. I mean, I think we found that out in a sense when we did the evaluation for the OYA facilities, and some of them were rather old, but some of them are not really that old, and they found a lot of deferred maintenance that hadn't been addressed, but had never been built into their budgets. So
actually, we're evaluating DOC's portfolio right now and expect to be done probably in March and April.
So the first piece of it is setting up some kind of mechanism so that it's budgeted in that they can do it. The other part of it, the second piece of it, is whether or not we're budgeting enough. So I know when I was the human services analyst for years, the state hospital had a total of $1.3 million for maintenance on that facility. That isn't even close to what those costs would be. So we didn't put enough into it. One of the things we're looking at with the DAS buildings right now is we're building what the costs are going to be for 17-19. Alice and Daniel are working very closely with the folks that do the facility maintenance for DAS now to look at what our depreciation fund is and start charging a number that's closer to what it would take to actually maintain all of our buildings. So part of that becomes a sticker shock question. And Mr. Rocco has raised before, Utah and other states have a standard for you put aside this much money for maintenance. And we will, based on the work that Alice and Daniel are doing, and this committee can help advise too, what are the right standards that we want to set up for that?
I just want to reiterate, I just want to make sure that the emphasis is that we protect what we have and that the routine maintenance is being performed so it doesn't end up in capital construction if we don't need it to end up in capital construction.
Agreed.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. So those are the big three definitions, and then we prioritize it by, you know, what is currently critical, and those are really life safety issues and failures. And then we look at what's potentially critical. That's near-term capital renewal kinds of projects, deferred maintenance. And then necessary and not critical. That's the same kind of work, but it's mid-term. So it's going to, it's just an issue of timing and being a bit further out. And then the last two categories, four and five for priorities, are modernizations. And largely that's functionality and program driven, where the program has changed over time and how it's driven, how it's delivered, so the facilities may or may not work anymore. And future code, what that really talks about is there are facilities that are grandfathered in their codes. And once you do a certain scale of intervention, you have to bring them up to code. So those are the things that we're looking at. And another area that we are also evaluating is resilience measures. And for us, that's about natural hazards, specifically seismic risks and flood. So we're evaluating our portfolio with respect to that as well. So the next, what we did to George's point is we hired a third-party professional architects, engineers, facility assessors to go through our facilities, to evaluate them in detail, put it into a software system, a program, so that we can, on an ongoing basis, manage and prioritize our investments in facilities. So it's totally driven. It is apples for apples. And we did a pilot program with three agencies, DAS, OLCC, and OIA. And what you're looking at is the summaries of what we found with those three agencies. Right now, as I said, we're doing DOCs, and they've got, you know, a lot of square footage. They're one of the biggest agencies. And we're getting ready to do ODFs, ODF&Ws, and ODOTs. So we'll, you know, make some more headway on that. For facilities, what really is a measure of the health of a facility or its condition is called a facility condition index. And that is the need of repairs or renewals, you know, the need over the current replacement value. And that's a calculated replacement value. And that metric tells you whether it's in good condition, fair condition, or poor condition, all along that spectrum. So what's considered good is anything that's 5% or less. Fair is 10% to 5%, and poor goes up to 60%. If you reach 60% of investment over the current replacement value, that's when you should start thinking about whether you should even have this facility. Then it stops making sense to actually continue investing in the facility.
So do you tear it down and build something different in its place, for example?
So the interesting thing, though, is that seismic, which hasn't been part of our evaluations in the past, is obviously something that we're doing for facilities that are $1 million and over that fit that time criteria, meaning they were built before 1995 and current codes, and ones that are 10,000 square feet and over, and we look at the mission value, how critical they are to delivering services for the state in the event of a Cascadia event. We look at, the cultural value. That's another metric. So that and the population. How many people are actually in this facility, and what is the risk if something happens? Then we do a benefit-cost analysis to say, for this investment, does it actually make sense? And at what buildings are particularly critical that will help us prioritize which ones to do first? But our plan is to address the seismic needs of our buildings as we do significant full-on renovations.
Has there been discussions,
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, please go ahead. Has there been discussions in that in terms of we recently approved bonding for $175 million for seismic improvements for schools?
Right.
But my understanding is those seismic improvements are to a standard to theoretically protect the lives of the individuals in there so that they have enough time to get out of the facility or the
right.
facility is not going to collapse to a point where that they're but they're not actually that the facility would be usable after a significant earthquake.
That's right.
So what sort of standard, I mean, we really don't have a lot of resources, but what sort of standard have we contemplated using?
I think the minimum standard is what you describe. And it depends. I think is what we would look at is what is the function of the facility. And if the facility is critical and people need to remain in the facility, and we use the measure for that we use is the FEMA standards and the building code standards. So we look at things like, I mean, interestingly, first responder facilities, critical facilities for the operation of government, the continuing operation of the government, prisons,
yeah.
hospitals, facilities like OIA. So those are the priorities to develop higher standards. So we're looking at reasonableness to the extent we can, define that. But we've got good people thinking about this very carefully with us.
I got a question.
Absolutely.
That probably goes to the word reasonableness. We're trying to prepare for an earthquake that we don't know if it's going to be a 9 or a 6. So I'm trying, or when I say that, I mean this to the level, and that's a tremendous amount of difference as to how we'll do in Salem, given those two numbers. So I'm just trying to, what numbers are you using aside for the Cascadia event?
Yeah, we're using 9. So on what we are doing is we are working with scientists. We're working with Dogami. We're working with Portland State. We're working really with, and, you know, we've talked to our colleagues at OSU, at OSPAC. This is a pretty informed conversation. We're not the scientists, but what we have are, you know, the science and engineering expertise that is helping us formulate this. The same group that developed the benefit-cost analysis that is being used by the public school bonding program are also, we're using that, modifying it for state facilities so that we have that that same approach. And I think that this is exponential, as you well know. But
that's what I'm saying, a number between 6 and 9 to the average person might not sound very
right.
big. But it's
enormous.
It's enormous.
Right.
And 9's the biggest thing I've ever had. So with a 70-foot tidal wave, that's the largest that it's ever been. So, you know, and that goes back thousands and thousands of years. So it'd be nice to prepare for a 9, but I'm not sure it's cost-effective. If we're going to spend money, maybe I'd rather spend some money relocating to the next school than I would trying to elevate something from an 8 to a 9, and if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense, but we are, in the interventions that we're doing for the buildings, mm-hmm. Just for example, for the executive building, actually, which is a very vulnerable building, the seismic interventions, just the structural alone, is not that exorbitant. I mean, that's because the building isn't that large, but it's, I think it varies. I think your point is a really good one, but the science has been clear to us that 9 is really what we should be looking at. And that.
How do you compare that, though, in terms of if you ever had the resources to allocate? If you were looking at that and you said, well, this is what we're going to plan for. We have 90 facilities that are critical. Our money, if we're trying to plan for this, runs out in 4 facilities. I mean,
your point is a great one. So I think we can't solve everything. So there are some things that we can't do and some things that we must do. Yeah. So I think we are trying to, it's a discussion. It's not absolute. So we are trying to look at each individual project and see what we can, you know, what is wisdom really to try to pull that project together and see if it makes sense. You know, we do benefit cost analysis too. If the BCA doesn't work out, we won't do it.
I sat on that committee and I was along with Dogami and
yeah.
trying to figure out. And I have to be honest, they weren't dealing with a full deck over there. The numbers they came up with that we needed to be spending was $250 billion.
Wow.
No. So, I mean, we don't have $250 billion. And that's why I think it's important that we prioritize, you know, and I'm saying going from an 8 to a 9 might not be as high a priority as moving some schools or doing some things to try to save lives. So I think we have to look at it from a first dollar perspective, not from $250 billion, which... I mean, that's just totally unreasonable given what we're capable of doing.
Senator, I couldn't agree with you more, but that is, I think, why what we're trying to get as much information as possible, look at the range of options, and kind of look at what is possible to execute, because we also are not interested in developing a list that is impossible to do. That's not helpful. We're trying to prioritize in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, and if I can jump in here for a second, Senator, I absolutely, we can't afford to get all the buildings up where we need to go. And I don't, and that's where your decisions become really critical, is the strategic nature of which ones we do when.
Right.
The issue is that we don't know when that will hit us, whether it's next year or 50 years from now or 200 years from now. So we just want to keep chugging away at it. Now, I will tell you, that, for example, the Oregon Transportation Commission, they are prioritizing looking at, there are certain routes that you've got to make sure that there is a path to get commerce going in. You may not be able to keep everything up and running, but we got to make sure that there are paths in so that the commerce after the shaking stops and 5 months later we can actually still have businesses going on in key areas. So the prioritization is absolutely what has to happen. We still need to keep chunking on it. Hopefully we got 50 years from now, and over 50 years we can get all of them to a nine. But you're right, we can't afford it right away. We just have to strategically choose.
All new buildings, I think it's essential that you make them to a code of nine. But when I would concur with what you were saying.
Great. Okay. So this I'm just going to go through very quickly.
Well, actually, can we go back to the prior slide? Because I think this is, so we've invested a fair amount of money, and you've invested a fair amount of money into DAS to do this engineering assessment, architectural assessment into our buildings. And I think this is important to see. Of the three agencies we've done it on, probably the majority of them come in with good, the status of their building is actually good, where it is right now. That's what the only 2.4% of it is in the fair, poor, or very poor stage.
Actually, if we can look at the next slide, that helps describe that.
Yes.
So what it really shows is that DAS, because of its program, our facilities on the whole are in very good shape. OLCCs are in poor shape, as are OIAs. So, I mean, it's very clear. Their need is pretty immediate, but if they get that, if they actually do that relatively soon, then their overtime need is pretty low. But what the nature of our portfolio is, our current need is actually very low, but our projected need, because of the age of our facilities and the fact that major systems are at the end of their lifespan, and many of them are beyond their lifespan, we actually will have a lot of need coming up in the next decade, and really, frankly, in the next 4 years. So,
and this chart highlights for me that the importance of doing that, charge yourself rent, put the money into depreciation fund so you can do the ongoing maintenance. I think that's the biggest difference between these three agencies, and I think one of the policy choices we should look at.
Okay, so the graph down at the bottom, what that shows you is, you know, and it's by color, what the needs are by the agency. You can see for DAS, which is the one with the peaks, our current need relative to the size of our portfolio and its value is really very low. But we've got spikes in 16 and 19, whereas the other agencies, their needs are now, and then it kind of flattens out. But what we're suggesting is that the FCI for the overall portfolio should not never be greater than 0.1. It should at least be fair for all of our buildings. We shouldn't have any poor condition buildings. We don't have to have perfect buildings, but they need to be, you know, within a reasonable range. So,
and ultimately, this is a stuff, Senator, that you can actually then use to then start figuring out how much do I need to start setting aside so that when I have to replace the roof, I've got enough cash in the bank. In the past, it's just been, here's how much we set aside. I'm going to deal with everything I can within that amount. Whereas this approach is more, here's the things I know are coming up, how far ahead, how much do I need, very much like I do in my own home and many business people do.
Right. So now these agencies have the data to be able to do that.
Yep.
The next one just shows DAS's spikes. And if we have time, is there anything that you want to
do?
So I'm going to go through this really quickly, but the one thing that you should know is that we're working with LFO to update our capital budget submission forms so that they're easier to read, that they're more informative, and more useful. The, you know, what our process is, I don't think we really have time to get into that today.
Oh, yeah. I think not the forum side of it, but the next series of these slides are important to see.
Okay, great. So from the process, there's the CPAP, Capital Planning Advisory Board, which does really the due diligence on projects. Capital Planning Commission, which looks at zoning and land use issues. DAS, we are the facility planning unit. We're the system of record for the inventory. And we do planning assists for agencies. We disseminate best practices. We help prioritize. And we develop policies that promote, you know, good stewardship. The metrics that we're looking at, one is the Facility Condition Index. That's a real valuable metric that we're going to be using now. Another one is the cost of O&M against gross square foot. That's something that we actually track now at an agency level, but not necessarily a building level. But this is a really useful metric that helps, you know, for different building types, there are different acceptable ranges. So that's a useful one to measure ourselves against. And another one is looking at our utilization rates. So for this is the idea of right-sizing our portfolio. For offices and administrative kinds of functions, there's a usable square feet per position count. And what we're right now, our standard is about 250 square feet per position, but we are looking at reducing that so that one, we have maybe smaller individual spaces, more common spaces, and that we can reduce the cost of the portfolio, make it more flexible, and reflect how people actually work these
days. And we're going to see this on the next series of slides. So I'm going to use the example of the DCBS building where DCBS is located. So Director Allen over there was looking at his space and realizing that he, when you look at his square footage, number of people per the square foot, from a building perspective, he had a really, really high ratio. At the same time, we're moving in the Cover Oregon functions into there. And Director Allen recognized that he had space that was spread out throughout the building just because there were vacant cubicles. And so they went through a process to what we call re-sacking the building, which is consolidate people, get rid of the extra space, and he was able to absorb inside their building an entire new work unit because they had reconfigured how they're using their existing space. And you're going to see in the visualizations, if we can move into those now, based on the information we're getting and how we're starting to visualize stuff, you're actually able to see that kind of stuff, and that's exciting for us.
Okay, so these are communication tools.
The idea here is that we want to use dynamic tools so that our users and you, our constituents, can actually use the information and do analytics in real time. So we have a couple of apps that we've developed. You know, nothing is fully baked, but you know, this shows you just kind of where we are at this point. We'd love to demonstrate it to you, but actually, the bandwidth is not enough here to actually demonstrate it live. So these are just a bunch of canned shots. So the idea is that it could be deployed on an iPad, you know. So here's the revenue building in a 3D app. And this is just a representation of density where by floor, where there is the green is good, the red is bad, meaning that we could achieve more density on those floors. So this is just a way of looking at things very quickly to see how they, you know, to see the data represented.
So we can actually do a snapshot of a building and say, here's where we got vacancies. And the more we're working with agencies, the more they see how this can help them better utilize their own space.
Right. So it's all a matter of the level of information that we have. And then we've got, we're developing programs that allow us to do it in three dimensions, which makes it easier for users to see and comprehend where they are.
And this is real data. This is what we've got. Is that correct for the revenue building?
Yeah. And it's,
I mean, well, this
reversed.
Is, again, a moment in time.
Yeah, yeah. It's a snapshot.
This is, first priority was to see, can we do something that actually works? So that was, you know, it was a pilot.
it works. It's pretty easy to do. Then we put in data and real data to see, can we visualize something that actually is meaningful to people? We can do that. It's pretty easy. The next step is, can we do this dynamically? So we upload the data, we change the data, it just updates itself. So the, on the consumer side, you're getting the most current up-to-date stuff.
I like it.
And you can,
it's pretty impressive.
You know, as an information consumer, you know, you can decide what you want to look at and the story that, you know, you want to.
I think there'd be an overlap with security as well.
Yeah.
And Senator, if Alice can show you the next series of them, there's a whole bunch of different applications for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, where, yeah, we put in flood, you know.
Floodplains.
These are just switches that you put in.
So you told me you had soil types, too, at one time.
You could do soil types. You can do subterranean stuff.
Because that would, the impact of the earthquake.
Right.
So can you scroll back to what this was, just so people can see it? That's Mill Creek.
This is the North Mall area.
Right.
A lot of buildings up there, and notoriously prone to
flooding.
Flooding, but I think this puts like a visual kind of impact to it. It's like you can kind of see it. What that's just the 105-year floodplains, which is
so you can see if we start to get heavy rain, where do we got to cover? What's the issues?
But I think the advantage of this is it helps illustrate when people are bringing projects forward. One of the things that we're asking everybody to consider, and we've actually developed a policy around this, is how to address the issue of natural hazards in their future development, in their current facilities, which they do, and in future development. You know, where should you develop? Why? What are the things that you need to look at when you're proposing sites? And this has not been routinely done. So it's just these kind of...
It leads to conversations. We had a conversation during the last budget cycle about the military department wanted to locate another facility out by the Anderson Readiness Center. Alice's work in this area, Daniel's work in this area, started going, this is in a floodplain. What's your mitigation strategy? And they spent a lot of time working with you, and they ultimately said, yeah, we've got this covered.
Right.
I think, you know, at a philosophy, those conversations shouldn't happen without at least some context and information, which will make that as easy as possible. And I think, you know, these tools have actually enabled some conversations to happen, like George said. So,
right.
What was the last one? You went past it real quick. This is
operating costs. So we can just symbolize buildings by those dimensions that we talk about in different ways. One way is just to say, give me a color ramp. Low operating cost is green, so that's good in our book. Red, there needs to be some work, and there's some buildings that are not performing as well.
Either energy use is just too high, or it could be in a number of different things.
And with all of these, what the app allows you to do is go to the building, open it up, and then you can actually see all of the data associated with that building. And then you can turn toggles on and off. I mean, it has a lot of functionality that allows you to do comparative while you're looking at things. The point of this is to allow us to do queries and analytics to see what should we target, what should we prioritize, what makes sense to do. And having the contextual understanding of lots of different dimensions instead of looking at 52 charts, it just allows you to come to conclusions much more quickly and have a discussion more easily with people. So that's the intent.
So we have two last ones, and I think then we're going to run out of time, so we'll have to wrap up.
So these are map apps, which this is a screenshot, so it's pretty grainy. But the point is that we have the portfolio all put into a map. And then depending upon the data, you can zoom in to an area. You can look at, you know, for example, if we've got a bunch of leases or an agency that we know wants to lease in this area, we can look at who is in that area now, what leases are there, who are the agencies, what buildings do we own there, is there any opportunity to co-locate and to lease, when are their leases coming due. So you can run queries pretty quickly in a, you know, locational way. It just saves an enormous amount of time and allows you to focus in on the issues pretty simply. you know, you could look at your district. You know, that's another overlay. And you could say, who is in my district? Where are they? How many people are there? Whatever data we have, we can give to a locational attribute, including all of, you know, DOGAMI's maps and the FEMA maps and, you know, demographic data. All of that we can put into these different apps.
I was actually at Metro from 89 to about 94, and they had a fully functional GIS system by about 91, I believe. 90. They were so far ahead of the state government and local government at that time with multiple layers. But obviously, even back in then, it was very antiquated in the sense that a lot of things had to be manually, digitally inputted. I mean, literally, which was very intense. But I'm wondering, can I go back to a question I have? The seismic issue, I think one of the very clear issues you're going to have is you identify a structure that has a seismic problem, even in a 7 earthquake. But it's gradually getting into that stage where it's going to get into your classification of being poor or being unacceptable. Do you make the investment in the building to just bring it up in terms of the standards of the building?
Actually,
well, I mean, I think you almost have to, in a sense, unless you're going to build another building.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Again, I think what we are doing is things are bad, but we want to know how bad.
Yeah.
You know, and we want to know who else is in there. Because there isn't infinite money, how do we prioritize what we're going to do when?
And just out of curiosity, the kind of last question is, I know you did an analysis on the, what's the old name for it? There's nobody there from Bowie anymore. The Labor and Industries building. How did that come out?
It's bad.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Senator, there are a couple of our buildings, LNI, which is where DCBS is one of those buildings. I think there's two or three of them that we're watching pretty closely.
But revenue is very bad. Yeah.
You know, Labor and Industries, that's the building that's over there on the far corner.
And the executive building is also.
Yeah. So, and certain of those buildings, Senator, you make the decision, we're gonna actually do the repairs inside the buildings to actually structurally make them sound. But you're right, some of it you go back to that facility condition index. I know we had that conversation this last budget cycle. Is it worth putting into the executive building the cost to refurbish it given where the facility is? Is the better strategy just tear the whole thing down and build a new building? And that's a cost benefit analysis that Alice and Daniel have been working on. Where does that crossover actually happen?
Right.
You don't have too many buildings like this, but that was the kind of analysis on Lincoln Hall too. If you had deferred things a few more bienniums, you would have been replacing the building.
Yes.
And nobody wanted to also go through the hearings to tear down a historic building to replace it. So.
Well, I'm convinced now that, especially after being with DOGAMI, that we have to start looking at other areas to put state buildings that other than the city of Salem and Portland, because they're really going to get hit by a major earthquake, whereas if you go a few miles to the east up in my district, we're not going to do so bad. So
I'll let you argue with the Senate President.
Peter and I. Maybe I'll outlast Peter. I don't know.
Anything else for right now?
I don't think so.
I'm worried about meteor attacks.
Asteroids or comets?
Tell me this, if you...
We should start planning for
I know that. You're not retiring for another decade. But when you retire, are you going to stay here?
Stay where?
Oregon.
It depends on what you do with the purse.
Depends what the income tax rate is.
Okay, with that... Well, we're adjourned.